Application Academy is closing if you are applying to medical school in 2024 to start in 2025. We are closing in mid-April, April 12th or 13th, somewhere around there, somewhere in mid-April. We're closing our door. It's time for you to get in to Application Academy to get the support you need to put together your story so that you aren't one of those students that end up rejected because you didn't know how to tell your story. Come join us at applicationacademy.com. Use the promo code podcast for a little extra discount. Use the promo code podcast for a little extra discount. I'll see you soon at applicationacademy.com. The pre-med path can be super confusing. If you'd love some help on your path or on your applications, use the promo code PMY for pre-med years, PMY, over at medicalschoolhq.net and get some help from some of our experts, former directors of admissions, admissions officers, other experts. We have a small team ready to help you today. Again, that's promo code PMY to get a discount on our services at medicalschoolhq.net. The Medical School Headquarters Podcast, session number 160. Hello and welcome to the Medical School Headquarters Podcast, where we believe that collaboration, not competition, is key to your pre-med success. I'm your host, Dr. Ryan Gray, and in this podcast, we share with you stories, encouragement, and information that you need to know to help guide you on your path to becoming a physician. But today I have a very special guest joining me. It's Adele Wolfson. She's a biochemistry teacher for the last umpteen years, and we're going to talk all about kind of the liberal arts degree and her take on why it's so important. Now, I found Adele through an essay that she wrote. And in this essay, she talks about how there's this big kind of swing away from strictly science-based students and having students that just can crush the MCAT and can crush all of their prereqs to having students that have people skills and learning sociology, learning psychology in the humanities. And Adele looks at it from her point of view of being a liberal arts teacher for the last many years, as I said earlier. But she goes and she talks about how kind of science is so much more than just rote memorization of facts. And there's just so much more with analyzing data and putting it into context, and how liberal arts degrees and students that study liberal arts are able to integrate a lot of that information a lot better. And it's an awesome discussion. Take a listen to it. If you're beginning your journey into undergrad and you're trying to figure out what you should study, or even maybe where to go to undergrad if you're a high school student at this stage, or maybe a non-traditional student looking to go back and do something different, take a listen to this episode and hear some of the arguments for maybe why studying a liberal arts degree and getting your prereqs on the side or in conjunction with your liberal arts degree might be the best thing for everybody, yourself, your patients, and your colleagues. After the interview with Adele, I'll answer a couple questions that were called in, and we'll wrap it up at the end. Adele, thanks for joining me.
I'm very happy to be here.
Now, you've been a biochemistry teacher now for some years, and I don't want to date you, but you have seen a huge transition, I'm assuming, in the biochemistry world as it relates to medicine and medical school and how the admissions process to medical school has changed over those years that you've been a professor. Can you talk a little bit about what you've seen from the professor side of the students that you see, or even the curriculum that you're teaching for, I guess, pre-meds in specifically?
Sure. I think there are two things that are involved in your question and in my answer. One has to do with the preparation of students and the expectations for them, and the other has to do with the field itself. So as far as expectations, I would say that almost nobody took biochemistry as an undergraduate in the early days. My first teaching was actually at medical schools, and the students coming into those courses had almost never had biochemistry as undergraduates, so we were starting from scratch in terms of teaching that material. Now I think there's a huge expectation that everybody will have seen biochemistry as an undergraduate, and in fact that it is the underpinnings of much of what they do in their, certainly in their preclinical years, and I would say also in their clinical years. I would say that there were no real majors in biochemistry in the early days. It was really that you took chemistry and biology, but there was no point at which you could connect those two disciplines until medical school or graduate school. And these days, biochemistry is, as you probably know, one of the large interdisciplinary majors and is almost to the point of not being considered interdisciplinary. It's its own field. So that's what I would say as far as the changes in preparation and expectations. As far as the field itself, we all know that biochemistry, like all of the sciences, is exploding because of the new tools that we have and also for the great interest in the field and the amount of money that flows into it, both from the government, from universities, and from the pharmaceutical industry and biotech more generally. So it's hard to keep up with that. Everybody knows that textbooks get bigger and bigger and bigger every year. And certainly the explosion in molecular biology, molecular genetics has changed it a lot from the years when I was a student myself and even when I began to teach. So everybody, I hope, understands that there's no way to cover the breadth of that field. So my approach has been to do great depth in particular areas, to teach the tools of learning that material, but not try to survey all of it. And I worry that there is still some desire to survey all of biochemistry, which is a hopeless task. So that's what I would hope to convince people not to do. Since the information is going to continue to change, what you really want is a solid foundation in the core disciplines and the ability to learn new material as it arises.
I think that's a great tactic. And even as students progress through medical school, I think what they're teaching in medical school, it changes every year, every day. And so again, it's the tools that you're teaching to go out and find what that new information is and the new knowledge is.
Absolutely.
So it's interesting. I didn't necessarily know that biochemistry wasn't an undergrad class back in the day, but now we have the MCAT, this behemoth of a test for pre-meds that they need to take to get into the majority of medical schools. And the MCAT is now testing biochemistry on their exam. So it's basically required now for every pre-med student to take biochemistry. From your point of view, are we going in the right direction with a step like that, or are we going in the wrong direction?
Well, as a biochemist, it's hard for me to argue against people taking lots of biochemistry. I think it's a fabulous field, and I wouldn't want to keep anybody from learning it. I think, as for almost everything, if you have, again, the right background and the right tools, you can learn it at any stage. And I didn't see that people were greatly disadvantaged in the old days by coming in cold into those fields, that they took an introductory biochemistry course in their first year of medical school, even if they had never seen biochemistry before. They had gotten up to speed pretty quickly in comparison to people who might have seen it as undergraduates. But I do think that it's, you know, again, I fell in love with biochemistry. That's why I'm a biochemist. I think that it allows you to understand why you learn chemistry and why you learn biology when you start to combine those two. So I'm not going to argue against people taking it as undergraduates. I do just hope, like for every field, every discipline, I would hate to have you just repeat the same thing when you get to the next stage. So one of my great interests in teaching and in research about education is how students can go through a progression of learning. And so I don't want people learning the same thing in biochemistry as undergraduates that they learned, for example, in introductory chemistry, which sometimes feels like it's the case. And I don't want people in medical school learning the same biochemistry that they learned as undergraduates. That seems a waste of their time. And again, given what I just said about the breadth of the discipline, being able to learn either new parts of the field or go into more depth in it than they were able to do as undergraduates.
Yeah, I think it is frustrating from a medical student point of view of just repeating stuff. Now, it's interesting. Well, I want to dig into this essay that you wrote and the reason that I reached out to you. The essay is titled Science Matters. Now, I want to start the discussion by asking you, if you had a loved one in the hospital, would you want their physician to be a liberal arts major or a biochemistry major?
So I think the biochemistry is a liberal art. I don't see those as two ends of a spectrum. I think that every student should know sufficient science to be a good physician, and every student should know enough of the liberal arts and humanities, of the humanities and social sciences to understand how the world works on a social level and on an artistic level. So I don't see those as opposed to one another, but I do want to make sure that people know enough science to understand the underlying processes that they're dealing with in seeing patients and interpreting results and reading blood work and trying to diagnose.
And that's been a huge shift in the admissions committee process, the admissions process to medical school. Is 20 years ago, the admissions committee seemed to want science-focused students, ones that were just dedicated to science, and they didn't care about any of the other stuff. Why do you think there's such a huge shift in bringing the humanities into medicine now?
Well, I think that everybody has the experience of dealing with physicians who are not very good at working with patients, and they would like some more social skills and knowledge of the world in which the patients live. Certainly, understanding the communities in which they reside, understanding some of the economic and social pressures that they experience in addition to their health problems can help the physician be a better physician and aid to their patients. So I have no problem with that at all. My issue in writing that piece, I really was responding to a couple of pieces that I had either read or heard on the radio or in newspapers that was saying there was no point in physicians or pre-med students having seen some of the pathways and memorizing them, et cetera, because they never use those again. And my reaction was, well, if all you did was memorize them, then there wasn't any point to them. The point was to understand what was going on there. And I think the more science you know, the deeper you can understand it, and the more knowledge of that you can bring to the rest of your care for your patients. So I was not trying to put those two in opposition, the liberal arts or the humanities and social sciences to the natural and physical sciences. I was simply trying to say that the amount of science that you learn does matter, that you can't come into medicine without a deep knowledge of science, and particularly of biochemistry, but I would also say physiology, microbiology, immunology. There's a lot of things that you need to understand on a molecular level in order to see your patient on the macroscopic level and as a member of society. So I'm just trying to say don't throw out the baby with the bathwater because you thought that there was not enough of the social end of pre-med education. Don't replace the science with that, but try to find the best parts of both of those to come into it.
There are programs out there now, like Mount Sinai's FlexMed program, and I had Dr. Muller on a long time ago, back in episode 16, talking about the FlexMed program, and it seems like they kind of are replacing some of the science with humanities, or at least replacing the sciences with allowing the student to kind of follow their own passions, whether it go be traveling abroad or learning a romantic language. Do you think that's going too far in the wrong direction, or are they finding a happy medium somewhere?
well, I would be interested in hearing what the outcomes are for those physicians. And it may well be that it works out fine for them. As I say, I'm just concerned that the approach of saying that we don't need that much science means that the amount of science which goes in winds up being memorization and seeing science as just a tool as opposed to being a real discipline from which you can continuously move forward but always keep coming back to what that grounding is.
Yeah, I think ultimately, and I kind of we mentioned it already, is building that foundation of learning the scientific method and that type of thinking that goes into science and carry that foundation forward as you go. It really, as a physician now, looking back on my science years, whether it's physics or just basic chemistry or biochemistry, you don't use it day in and day out as a practitioner, but the foundation, the skills that you built to take those classes and to pass the classes and to study for the MCAT, those are all interwoven into who I am as a physician.
Well, I would hope so. I mean, the other thing that I feel that I'm fighting against in talking about putting in opposition the sciences to the other fields is this sense that science is a body of knowledge, and that is not all that it is. So it's not just a bunch of facts to memorize. It's not just a bunch of pathways that somebody worked out. It's figuring out how they worked out those pathways. And then what are the implications of the regulation of those pathways for your patient's health? I remember when I first learned the Krebs cycle or first learned metabolism as an undergraduate that I memorized all the pathways like people do. And then I walked into the exam and I was given a copy of the pathways. And I remember the sense of panic I had at that moment because I thought, everything that I know is just what's on this piece of paper. So what else could they possibly ask me? And that's when I finally began to understand that having those facts is just the starting point. Then you start to play with them and you say, well, what if this enzyme is missing? What if there's a breakdown in the regulation of this particular reaction? What happens? What are the implications of that? And that's what I feel like people can't do if all they do is see it as a bunch of facts. And I think that it's too often being taught that way, it's too often being tested that way, and therefore the students are, you know, reacting to what is reasonable for them, right? If they're going to be tested on it as a list of things to be memorized, they're going to memorize them. But if they're going to be given those things and then asked to work with them, then they're going to rise to that occasion.
Yeah, I think it's a whole nother podcast episode talking about how I think it's unfortunate how the MCAT drives a lot of what is taught. But I want to dig into the study that you published with some of your colleagues about mixing science and the humanities and some of the other disciplines with the STEM majors, the science and technology, engineering, mathematics majors. What did you ultimately come across with this study that you published?
So the paper that you're talking about is the Liberal Education of STEM Majors that I published with my colleague Lee Cuba in the sociology department and one of our undergraduates, Alexandra Day. The reason that we even did this study was because we're at a liberal arts college and we greatly believe in having the disciplines be situated in conversation with one another, right? That we don't expect that people will specialize so much that they would not see the other disciplines, but our greatest hope is that there would be a reason to connect those disciplines. So we wanted to see the experience of students who had explored further outside their field and those who had stuck more closely to their majors. And we were able to do this because my colleague Lee Cuba was part of a consortium that did a longitudinal study of students at seven different liberal arts colleges. And so we had interview data from them for their whole 4 years in school, in addition to a couple of years after graduation. So we really could look with some richness at the information they provided. And what we found, you know, is not surprising to me, because as I say, I'm from a liberal arts college and I greatly believe in this approach to education. What we found is that students who took the most courses outside of their major, and in this case outside of the STEM disciplines, were best able to learn that second discipline in some depth, And in the very best cases, we're able to make connections between those fields. So I see that as the ideal of a liberal arts education.
Define connections.
So connections means that they can talk knowledgeably about the ways in which knowledge is created in different fields. They understand what it means to do something in an analytical field that has lots and lots of data, and also within, for example, a literature field that uses narrative as their kind of data, and talk about both the shortcomings and the advantages of using those two different things, but also is able to say, oh, we took up this topic in our class in physics, for example, but we also took it up in our class in economics, and we looked at it from this somewhat different point of view, and we brought tools from those different fields in order to be able to understand the topic more completely. It also means that they know people in each of those fields, and it allows for collaboration in a way that we always hope will occur later in life when you're doing research or working in your profession, but they're able to make those collaborative connections even early in their academic career.
So if I'm looking at it from a collaborative perspective through research or in medicine, working with a tough patient, and I have a team of physicians that I'm working with, the physicians that have this ability to connect different disciplines and thoughts and ideas, they almost are the ones that are able to see beyond what us science-minded only people see. We're all hammers and we see everything as a nail, yet they see things in a much broader spect, almost from maybe a 30,000-foot view. Would that be how you would think about it?
Exactly. And vice versa. I would say that you probably bring something to the discussion that they might not be able to do. I also think that, you know, going back to this question of seeing patients within their societal and psychological framework, that you probably are not able to do, though, or maybe you can now because you've had practice, but that a fresh new physician might not be able to do. But by collaborating with a social worker, for example, or a psychologist, that you might be able to, do a better job for the patient than you would have on your own.
Yeah, it's interesting. A lot of the listeners that are listening right now are non-traditional students. And mm-hmm. I try to tell them when I talk to them, they think they're at a disadvantage because they're coming back from the workforce or doing something else for X number of years. But I try to explain to them that that's their leg up. They're able to communicate with patients on this level because they have that experience.
Right. And I think this is quite apart from medical school, but I think that it's important for anyone who's coming from a slightly non-traditional, if you will, or just different direction, that your strength is that what you think of as your weakness is often your strength, right? So the things that make you different may make it harder for you to navigate the system in kind of the way that a more privileged person might be able to do. But the fact that you have a different view and also the fact that you've been able to navigate it as well as you have means that you have particular strengths that the traditional student might not.
So how does a high school student or maybe an early college student who's out there trying to figure out what they should major in, staring down this gauntlet of courses that they quote-unquote need to take to prepare for the MCAT and what's required by the majority of medical schools out there, how do they see all of that and then try to fit in some of this other stuff to make them more well-rounded?
Well, my answer is going to be the same as it always is, that you should go to a liberal arts college. I don't think you should know what you're going to major in when you're in high school or maybe even in your first or second year of college. I think you should take the time to figure out what you're passionate about. Clearly, you need to be able to check those boxes if that's what medical schools are going to require. But I don't think that that actually fills up that much of your program. So if you come to college or even before college and you fall in love with biochemistry as I did, which I didn't actually do until pretty late in my life, I have to say, but relatively, if you fall in love with biochemistry, then sure, take all the biochemistry you possibly can. And that will mean, you know, by definition, that you'll fulfill all of the science requirements, and then take whatever psychology, sociology, English you're able to take that you really enjoy and that will add to your portfolio. But if you come to college and you're passionate about Greek, then major in classics, you know, and just make sure that you find enough time to put in the science and other courses that you need. I do think that passion is the most important thing for what you major in. And then you should take courses that interest you on top of that, right? So I hate to think of anything being taken just to check off a box. Probably it's going to happen for at least some of the courses that you take, but at least within the disciplines that you need for medical school, I hope that you like them enough that you're going to be able to spend time on them and to see the connections again to where you're going in terms of the profession that you've decided that you want to pursue.
I
just don't think that I think there's enough years and courses in college to take both the things that you have to take and the things that you really want to take.
Yeah, I think it's easier once we're on this side of it, and it's a lot harder as the incoming student when they're seeing all of these requirements.
I'm sure that's true, yes.
I think that was a great discussion about the benefits of the humanities in medicine and mixing and building those connections, as we talked about. I want to talk about biochemistry for a minute. I think it's interesting because the organic chemistries and the biochemistries of the world seem to be the biggest split between, that's the biggest filter for pre-med students. Why do you think biochemistry and organic chemistry, if you can talk about that, why do you think those classes seem to separate the ones that are good and the ones that are not cut out for it?
Well, I think part of it is just the reputations that they have, right? So I think a lot of people are already dreading organic chemistry before they come to college even, which makes no sense at all. Our students actually love organic chemistry because it's the first place that they see that you can be creative in chemistry. I think that for a lot of students, introductory chemistry, although it can be taught in a wonderful way, is often taught in a pretty dry way. And especially because people have seen it in high school in a not very good way, even if they get a great course in college, they're not really recognizing how open and creative and how many unanswered questions there still are in that field. But I think that when they get to organic, they begin to see that you really can be creative and that there's lots going on that's not in the textbooks even. And that's even more so for biochemistry, obviously. There's, you know, it's wide open. There's more that we don't know than we know. I do think that a lot of the reason that people are afraid of it and then don't like it or drop it or whatever is because it really does require an enormous amount of information before you can begin to be creative with it. So first you need that knowledge base, and then you can build on the knowledge base. You can't just jump ahead in the way that you might in a field where, you know, you can pick up a little bit and then build on that and then later come back and get some background information. So that's part of it. I think it's also, at least for biochemistry, this is actually not true of organic chemistry. I think organic chemistry requires a set of skills around seeing things in three dimensions, which is not taught that much in high school or early college. So it's a new skill and it's hard to learn. And so I think that some people, you know, don't either have an innate talent for that, or they're not willing to put in the time that it takes to get to that. Biochemistry, I think, is quantitative, at least in the way that we teach it in the early stages. Probably not in the advanced stages, but in the early stages, it's very quantitative, builds a lot actually on analytical chemistry and physical chemistry. And those are, there's a lot of people who are afraid of quantitative work. Either because, again, they didn't have a good background up to this point, or they've been told that they're not good at it, or that they just don't have good, they don't have good strategies for thinking about how to solve those kinds of problems. And so they get very hung up on those quantitative aspects, and it doesn't allow them to move into the more kind of model building, creative versions of biochemistry. And again, I think that there's been way too much memorization in the courses that have been presented, and people freak out about having to have that amount of information just kept in their head. I just don't see any reason to be holding that in your head when you can locate it pretty quickly.
For the pre-med student out there struggling in their organic chemistry or biochem specifically, what do you say to them to kind of pick them up by their bootstraps and get them going in the right direction to motivate them to find the right path and do well?
Well, I think there's no substitute for just doing as many problems as possible. So despite what I just said about being afraid of quantitative work, you have to do it, right? You can't understand the field unless you can do the basic work. So again, I'm not expecting people to memorize things. Maybe other people are, but I do expect anybody in a class to be able to look at a problem, figure out how it needs to be solved, what information you need in order to get there. And so I do think that, you know, doing as many problems as possible will give you that kind of, you know, just natural, it feels like natural talent after a while, even though it's not talent, it's learned. It's like an instrument. It's like a, you know, a sport that you play. You just practice a lot until you get to the point of being able to do it naturally without having to think about it. So I think, you know, getting that into your muscle memory is really important in all of these fields, but particularly in organic chemistry and in biochemistry. So as many practice problems as possible. But the other thing is, again, going back to the question of collaboration, I think that group work is just crucial. It's the way that we work once we are finished with college and graduate school and medical school. Almost nobody works alone. Maybe, you know, maybe poets, maybe mathematicians, but not even that. But certainly anybody who works in a lab science or in a, you know, clinical setting works in a team. And as you said earlier, having the contributions from all members of that team coming to it from different points of view is crucial. And I think it's also crucial when you're learning to do these problems. And so I think working in groups just gets to be one of the ways that you build that muscle memory in, but also allows you to see things from a direction that you might not have been able to see before.
All right. Again, that was Adele Wolfson, biochemistry teacher at Wellesley for the last several, many years. You can find the article. I'll put a link to it. Again, it's titled Science Matters. I'll put a link to it in the blog post specifically for this episode, which you can find at medicalschoolhq.net/160. Now, I want to go ahead and answer a couple of the questions that were called in to our question line, which you can find at medicalschoolhq.net/question.
Hello, my name is Brittany, and I'm calling from Tallahassee. And I just graduated this past December, and I listened to your podcast about starting out poorly, and I was wondering what would be your advice for someone who ended up poorly. I went from 3.6 my sophomore year to a 3.2 my senior year, spreading myself way too thin, trying to be president of all these clubs and shadowing, and I just let my GPA slip too much. And then once I graduated, I studied for the MCAT for 4 months, and I took it in May, I believe, and I ended up scoring a 499. And I was just wondering where you think I should go from there. I do plan on taking it again, but otherwise, what else do you guys recommend, S&P or post-bac? Thank you.
All right. To answer that question, it's pretty much the same as starting undergrad poorly, right? So as you progress through your undergrad years, you want to show a steady trend if you're doing very well the whole time, or an upward trend if you start off poorly. What medical schools definitely don't want to see is a downward trend in your grades. That shows that you're maybe suffering from some burnout. Maybe you're lacking some direction. Maybe you're questioning what you're doing and what you're going into. So they're going to have reservations about accepting a student that ends poorly, which is what Brittany's talking about here. But the advice in the podcast that I had with Dr. Politis, which you can find at medicalschoolhq.net/35, the discussion we had was what do you do when you start your pre-med path poorly? But ultimately, that discussion talked about ways to prove to the admissions committee that they should take a chance on you. And it's the same discussion here. Do you need to take an SMP? Do you need to do a post-bac, either a formal one or do-it-yourself one? Those are all questions that you'll need to answer based on really how poorly you did over your last year and what the rest of your grades look like. Your MCAT, the 499, not stellar. I don't know all the conversions off the top of my head with the old MCAT, but I think it's roughly 27-ish, maybe. So it's not stellar. It's not something that can make up for a bad year. And again, there's still going to be some reservations in there. So you need to go talk to your pre-med advisor. It sounds like being in Tallahassee, if you went to Florida State or FAMU, you'll have access to hopefully the pre-med advisors, even though you have now since graduated. Go talk to them and figure out what you need to do next. But ultimately, what you need to do is the same thing as if you start poorly, and that's just prove to the schools that you're ready to handle the medical school course load. Now, Brittany also called in another time with kind of a separate question here.
I'm currently taking a gap year while I get some shadowing in. And the hospital that I was shadowing in, they didn't have any doctors available. All they had was a PA. And I figured that I could get my feet wet and shadow the PA. He was working in the minor care unit. And I got really close with him, and he's taught me a lot. And I was wondering, would it be advantageous to get an LOR from him, or should I get an LOR from the doctor I'm currently shadowing? Thank you.
All right. So to answer that question is a little bit more straightforward than the last one. An LOR from a PA or from an NP or a nurse isn't going to help you much in the medical school admissions process. Obviously, if you're applying to a PA school, getting a letter of recommendation from a PA would be a good thing. Letters of recommendations from healthcare providers, you want them to be physicians, because ultimately they're writing a recommendation based on their career and you entering that career and how well they can see you working as a physician. So even though PAs and physicians have very similar jobs, they're different enough that I would not recommend getting a letter of recommendation from a PA. I do want to take a second to thank listeners that have taken a second to leave us a rating and review in iTunes. Dania1230 says, the hands down most relevant and useful info. Thank you for that. We have Dylan Copeland that says, best pre-med podcast, hands down. So lots of hand reviews going on here. Thank you, Dylan Copeland. We have Hawaii ACU that says mahalo for this podcast. I just love the word mahalo, so thank you for writing that. Mahalo for writing mahalo. That's awesome. And then we have one more here from, I have no idea, Go Ashley Go. Oh, that's what it says, Go Ashley Go. It says, a fellow non-trad pre-med turned me onto this podcast, and I have been listening weekly since. So here's what I want you to do. Go Ashley Go said it perfectly. somebody shared this podcast with her. And I want you to do the same thing. Go share it with your friends, your classmates, somebody else who has been thinking that going back to medical school has been right for them, somebody who's struggling in their undergrad years as a pre-med. Go share this podcast with them. You don't need to go leave a rating interview, although I like those. I want you to go share this podcast with your friend. If you do that, I will be forever grateful. As always, I hope you got a ton of information out of this podcast today, and I hope you join us next week here at the Medical School Headquarters.